Hello and welcome back to Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about The Barkai by Euripides, which is one of the plays in this book that I've got here on Greek tragedies. Now, why have I chosen to talk about this? Well, we have actually covered Euripides, one of Euripides' plays once before. Feels like quite a long time ago, to be honest, at this point, but some of those original chronicles that I did, we did something of a trilogy. We did Agamemnon with Stelios, looking at a really famous ancient Greek tragedy. And then I covered Lysistrata. And then we did The Cyclops, which was a satyr play by Euripides. It being written by Euripides was almost incidental because I wasn't really focusing on the fact that this was a Euripidean play. I was focusing on the fact that it was a satyr play because it was the only complete satyr play that we actually had surviving from antiquity. So now I just wanted to go through a proper Euripidean tragedy, talk about some of the characteristics that make it up. And also as well, the Barkai is such a fantastic story. One of the interesting things about Euripides is that in Nietzsche's very, very famous work, his original, his first book, In the Birth of Tragedy, he squarely points the finger at Euripides and accuses Euripides of being the man who brought about the death of tragedy. So I want to interrogate some of those ideas as well whilst we discuss the Barkai here, though it is a little bit more atypical as a Euripidean work, which is why I don't think that when Nietzsche basically comes along and says, oh yeah, the problem with Euripides is he took all of the Dionysian aspects out of theatre, or certainly, you know, minimise them and force the Apollonian forward. And then there does happen to be that one play right at the end of his career where he did the exact opposite of that. And this was right at the end of Euripides' career. In fact, this was so far towards the end of Euripides' career that he wasn't actually personally alive when it was first staged. Euripides passed away at the court of the King of Macedon in 406 BC. And one of the reasons as well, just to say, why Euripides went to that court was because he was just not appreciated very much in Athens at the time. Though Euripides was a regular writer for the city Dionysia, for the grand festival where the playwrights would be chosen by the city magistrate, and there would be a very healthy competition over who created, you know, the greatest trilogy of tragedies followed by a satyr play. So you wrote four plays and then obviously won gold, silver or bronze. And Euripides in his own lifetime only won this about four times, which is significantly less than the other great tragedians such as Aeschylus or Sophocles, Aeschylus being a fair bit before the other two. But nonetheless, there is an interesting irony to all of this, which is that though Euripides was always regarded very much as the bronze of these three writers in his own time, we actually have more of Euripides' plays than we do of Sophocles or Aeschylus. And one of the reasons for this is because actually there was something of a Euripidean revival after his death and after the expansion of Alexander the Great, right, in the Macedonian Empire, going throughout Persia and Alexandria, and of course the rest of Greece as well. And in this particular time period, Euripidean drama proved to be very, very popular. Part of the reason for that was because a lot of the Socratic ideas, you know, that had come down from Socrates further on, that rationality was really starting to take more and more of a root in Greek society. And there were themes in that about reason, virtue, happiness that were really spoken to by Euripides' style of writing, where we see the language. It's very hard for me personally to tell. I appreciate not being a native Greek speaker, but when you read something like the Orestia, as I've covered with Stelios in earlier episodes of the show, you see that the language, even though Euripides and Aeschylus are both writing tragedy, the language of Aeschylus is much more mythical. It feels deeper. It feels more ancient. It's more weighty, right? It has just much more sort of divine gravitas to it. Whereas by comparison, Euripides' language is much more ordinary. And this is one of the reasons why Nietzsche was not a huge fan of him. But we'll talk about all of this and more after we've been through the initial story. So let's begin talking all about the Barkai. Before the heroics of Heracles and the great trials of Perseus, there was Cadmus. Setting out from his father's Phoenician realm of Tyre, he pursued mighty Zeus, who had taken his sister Europa, whose name honours our continent. After submitting to the wisdom of Athena and the oracle at Delphi, Cadmus founded the city of Thebes in the land of Boeotia. From its founding, he governed as its king with justice and virtue for many years. But with advancing years, Cadmus reasoned that his kingship must pass to his grandson, Pentheus, who could rule with a prudence unwearied by age. The young lord is stubborn and stern. In another age, he might have been an austere but capable ruler. But fate had other plans for him. Descending from the mountains out of the east comes Dionysus, son of Zeus, and Cadmus's own daughter, Semele. The god means to avenge himself against all who deny his divinity, and heresies are spoken from on high within the royal family. Agave, mother of Pentheus, did not believe that her sister Semele had conceived a child with a god. In retribution against the unbelievers, and to defend his late mother's honour, Dionysus entrances Agave and her sisters, making them thralls to his will as they join the ranks of the Barkai, a primal Dionysian cult that has followed their god from distant Asia. The young god proclaims, "I am Dionysus, the son of Zeus. Come back to Thebes, this land where I was born. My mother was Cadmus's daughter, Semele by name, midwived by fire, delivered by the lightning's blast. And here I stand, a god incognito, disguised as man beside the stream of Dirce and the waters of Ismenus. There before the palace, I see my lightning-married mother's grave, and there, upon the ruins of her shattered house, the living fire of Zeus still smoulders on in deathless witness of Hera's violence and rage against my mother. But Cadmus wins my praise. He has made this tomb a shrine, sacred to my mother. It was I who screened her grave with the green of the clustered vine. Far behind me lie those golden rivered lands, Lydia and Phrygia, where my journeying began. Overland I went, across the steppes of Persia, where the sun strikes hotly down, through Bactria's fastness and the grim waste of Media. Thence to rich Arabia I came, and so, along all Asia's swarming littoral of towered cities where Greeks and foreign nations mingling live, my progress made. There I taught my dances to the feet of living men, establishing my mysteries and rites, that I might be revealed on earth for what I am, a god. And thence to Thebes, this city, first in Hellas, now shrills and echoes to my women's cries, their ecstasy of joy. Here in Thebes I bound the fawn skin to the women's flesh and armed their hands with shafts of ivy, for I have come to refute that slander spoken by my mother's sisters, those who least had right to slander her. They said that Dionysus was no son of Zeus, but Semele had slept beside a man in love and fathered off her shame on Zeus. A fraud, they sneered, contrived by Cadmus to protect his daughter's name. They said she lied, and Zeus, in anger at that lie, blasted her with lightning. Because of that offence, I have stung them with frenzy, hounded them from home up to the mountains where they wander, crazed of mind and compelled to wear my orgy's livery. Every woman in Thebes, but the women only, I drove from home mad. There they sit, rich and poor alike, even the daughters of Cadmus, beneath the silver firs on the roofless rocks. Like it or not, this city must learn its lesson. it lacks initiation in my mysteries, that I shall vindicate my mother Semele and stand revealed to mortal eyes as a god she bore to Zeus. Travelling in the guise of a mortal man, Dionysus descends from Mount Cithaeron, intent on subjugating this impious city. The Barkai honour him in their dress, draped in fawn skins, mantled by ivy, and clutching their fiercest staffs. With premonitions of the approaching force, Tiresias, a blind and ancient prophet of Apollo, beckons for the aged Cadmus to join him, and the two men rejoice at the arrival of this deity, donning the festive apparel of the Barkai in his honour. Dionysus is lord of all that blunts the brutalities of existence, wine, festivity, fertility, theatre, and of course, illusion. The two men mean to hobble their old bodies towards the hills and pay homage to the son of Zeus. We do not trifle with divinity. No, we are the heirs of customs and traditions hallowed by age and handed down to us by our fathers. No quibbling logic can topple them, whatever subtleties this clever age invents. People may say, aren't you ashamed at your age, going dancing, wreathing your head with ivy? Well, I am not ashamed. Did the gods declare that just the young or just the old should dance? No. He desires his honour from all mankind. He wants no one excluded from his worship. Because you cannot see, Tiresias, let me be interpreter for you this once. Here comes the man to whom I left my throne, Echion's son, Pentheus, hastening towards the palace. He seems excited and disturbed. Yes, listen to him. Pentheus enters, incensed by reports of the madness that has infected his people. Stories of our women leaving home to frisk in mock ecstasies among the thickets on the mountain, dancing in honour of the latest divinity, a certain Dionysus, whoever he may be. In their midst stand bowls brimming with wine, and then, one by one, the women wander off to hidden nooks where they serve the lusts of men. Priestesses of Bacchus, they claim they are, but it's really Aphrodite they adore. I have captured some of them. My jailers have locked them away, those who run away in the safety of our prison. Those who run at large shall be hunted down out of the mountains like the animals they are. Yes, my own mother Agave and Ino and Ortone, the mother of Actaeon. In no time at all I shall have them trapped in iron nets and stop this obscene disorder. I am told a foreigner has come to Thebes from Lydia. One of those charlatan magicians with long yellow curls smelling of perfumes, with flushed cheeks and the spells of Aphrodite in his eyes. His days and nights he spends with women and girls, dangling before them the joys of initiation in his mysteries. But let me bring him underneath that roof, and I'll stop his pounding with his wand and tossing his head. By God, I'll have his head cut off. And this is the man who claims that Dionysus is a god and was sown into the thigh of Zeus when, in point of fact, that same blast of lightning consumed him and his mother both for her lie that she had lain with Zeus in love. Whoever this stranger is, aren't such impostures, such unruliness, worthy of hanging? Cadmus tries to reason with his grandson. My boy, Tiresias advises well. Your home is here with us, with our customs and traditions, not outside, alone. Your mind is distracted now, and what you think is sheer delirium. Even if this Dionysus is no god, as you assert, persuade yourself that he is. The fiction is a noble one, for Semele will seem to be the mother of a god, and this confers no small distinction on our family. You saw that dreadful death your cousin Actaeon died when those man-eating hounds he had raised himself savaged him and tore his body limb from limb because he boasted that his prowess in the hunt surpassed the skill of Artemis. Do not let his fate be yours. Here, let me wreathe your head with leaves of ivy. Then come with us and glorify the god. Pentheus continues to seethe at the gaiety and mania that Dionysus' power have cast over his subjects. He prohibits any demonstrations of worship, and he orders his guards to arrest the foreign menace and bring him before the king to be sentenced. The god is brought before Pentheus in manacles, and there he stands, gentle and unafraid, in the humble guise of an old man. Untie his hands. We have him in our net. He may be quick, but he cannot escape us now, I think. Now then, who are you, and from where? It is nothing to boast of, and easily told. You have heard, I suppose, of Mount Tmolus and her flowers. It rings the city of Sardis. I know the place. I come from there. My country is Lydia. Who is this god whose worship you have imported into Hellas? Dionysus, the son of Zeus. He initiated me. You have some local Zeus who spawns new gods? He is the same as yours. The Zeus who married Semele. How did you see him? In a dream or face to face? Face to face. He gave me his rites. What form do they take, these mysteries of yours? It is forbidden to tell the uninitiate. Tell me the benefits that those who know your mysteries enjoy. I am forbidden to say, but they are worth knowing. Your answers are designed to make me curious. No, our mysteries abhor an unbelieving man. You say you saw the god. What form did he assume? Whatever form he wished, the choice was his, not mine. You evade the question. Talk sense to a fool, and he calls you foolish. Have you introduced your rites in other cities too, or is Thebes the first? Foreigners everywhere now dance for Dionysus. They are more ignorant than Greeks. They are not. Customs differ in this matter. Do you hold your rites during the day or night? Mostly by night. The darkness is well suited to devotion. Better suited to lechery and seducing women. You can find debauchery by daylight too. You shall regret these clever answers. And you, your stupid blasphemies. What a bold barkant! You wrestle well when it comes to words. Tell me, what punishment do you propose? First of all, I shall cut off your girlish curls. My curls belong to God. My hair is holy. Pentheus shears away the god's curls. Second, you will surrender your wand. You take it. It belongs to Dionysus. Pentheus takes the thyrsus. Last, I shall place you under guard and confine you in the palace. The god himself will set me free whenever I wish. You will be with your women in prison when you call on him for help. He is here now and sees what I endure from you. Where is he? I cannot see him. With me. Your blasphemies have made you blind. Seize him. He is mocking me and Thebes. I give you sober warning, fools. Place no chains on me. But I say, chain him, and I am the stronger here. You do not know the limits of your strength. You do not know what you do. You do not know who you are. I am Pentheus, the son of Echion and Argive. Pentheus, you shall repent that name. Off with him. Chain his hands, lock him in the stables by the palace. Since he desires the darkness, give him what he wants. Let him dance down there in the dark. As for these women, your accomplices in making trouble here, I shall have them sold as slaves or put to work at my looms. That will silence their drums. As Dionysus is taken away, his devoted Bacchae chant in prayer for their divine lord. Suddenly, Pentheus' palace is struck with elemental fury. Fire and lightning strike its pillars as an earthquake raises its very foundations. Pentheus is wrathful, not only at the destruction of his palace and pride, but at the sight of this troublesome foreigner returning to his side, unbound and quite alive. Before Pentheus can act on his frustrations, however, a messenger approaches with tidings from Mount Cithaeron. Sir, I have seen the holy Maenads, the women who ran barefoot and crazy from the city, and I wanted to report to you and Thebes what weird, fantastic things, what miracles and more than miracles these women do. But may I speak freely in my own way and words, or make it short? I fear the harsh impatience of your nature, sire, too kingly and too quick to anger. Speak freely. You have my promise. I shall not punish you. Displeasure with a man who speaks the truth is wrong. However, the more terrible this tale of yours, the much more terrible will be the punishment I impose upon that man who taught our women folk this strange new magic. It happened, however, that Agve ran near the ambush where I lay concealed. Leaping up, I tried to seize her, but she gave a cry. Hounds who run with me, men are hunting us down, follow, follow me, use your wands for weapons. At this we fled, and barely missed being torn to pieces by the women. Unarmed, they swooped down upon the herds of cattle, grazing there on the green of the meadow. And then you could have seen a single woman, with bare hands tear a fat calf, still bellowing with fright in two, while others clawed the heifers to pieces. There were ribs and cloven hooves scattered everywhere, and scraps smeared with blood hung from the fir trees, and bulls, their raging fury gathered in their horns, lowered their heads to charge, then fell, stumbling to the earth, pulled down by hordes of women, and stripped the flesh and skin more quickly, sire, than you could blink your royal eyes. Like invaders, they swooped on Hysia and on Erythrea in the foothills of Cithaeron. Everything in sight they pillaged and destroyed. They snatched the children from their homes, and when they piled their plunder on their backs, it stayed in place, untied. Nothing, neither bronze nor iron, fell to the dark earth. Flames flickered in their curls and did not burn them. Then the villagers, furious at what the women did, took arms. And there, sire, was something terrible to see. For the men's spears were pointed and sharp, and yet drew no blood, whereas the wands the women threw inflicted wounds. And then the men ran, routed by women. Some god, I say, was with them. The Barkai then returned where they had started, by the spring the god had made, and washed their hands while the snakes licked away the drops of blood that dabbled their cheeks. Whoever this god may be, sire, welcome him to Thebes, for he is great in many other ways as well. It was he, or so they say, who gave the mortal men the gift of lovely wine by which our suffering is stopped. And if there is no god of wine, there is no love. No Aphrodite either, nor other pleasures left to men. In defence of his people and kingdom, Pentheus determines that he will meet these frenzied women with an army, exposing their crimes and restoring peace to his withering realm, and purging it of this subversive sect.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.